Hello, I'm Peter J. Radomski. This is number 0287, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0287. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actress Yvette Nicole Brown is back on the show. Formerly from the series Community, she's now joining the new CBS revival of The Odd Couple. Why the move in shows?
I needed to take some time to take care of my dad, and Community is a single camera show, so it shoots 80 hours a week. That's like from 5:30 in the morning to like 8 o'clock at night, so you know, you can imagine what that's like every week. And I just couldn't do it and adequately care for my dad, so I had to, you know, ask for it to be released, and thankfully Sony and Dan Harmon gave me their blessing. And then maybe a month or so after that, I got offered the chance to be on The Odd Couple. So it really, I look at The Odd Couple as like a blessing that came because I put my family first.
Ivor Davis is the author of The Beatles and Me on Tour, about the legendary tour of 1964.
The moment I hit San Francisco to join the Beatles and discovered 4,000 young women outside their hotel screaming, I knew something was afoot. And then, of course, during the tour all the way across America into Canada, the same thing happened. I thought, this is quite insane, and this must be par for the course. Of course, I didn't know it wasn't, and I didn't know that the Beatles were about to make rock and roll history.
Actor Hugh O'Brien has written his memoir, Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him. Why the subtitle of the book, or What's Left of Him?
Well, when you get to be 89, like I am, certain things are not happening anymore. One of those for me is my old Marine Corps knees. And therefore, I'm using a walker. But that's kind of fun, because using the walker always gets me somehow into first class.
And, of course, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0287, was Montreal stand-up comic Peter J. Radomski, who has appeared on the Just for Laughs stages on more than one occasion, and also even on The Daily Show, and can be seen in many clubs here in Montreal. If you ever get here, check out Peter J. Radomski. Thank you very much, Peter, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? In January, Captain Mercedes, a registered user of the Reddit.com social media site, announced he had compiled a data file cataloging every bowel movement he had in 2014 and was offering the file to other users to design hypotheses and visual representations of the data in ways that might improve his relationship with his alimentary canal. Now, according to the data analysis website, 538.com, the researcher, and boy, I'm doing air quotes here, used the standard Bristol stool scale. That's seven categories of excreta by shape and consistency, and produced interesting hypotheses in the ensuing Reddit conversation, which you can check online if you really want to. That's reddit.com/user/CaptainMercedes. Oh, he just has to be single. He has to be. And you know, people often say that there is just so much information out there on the internet. That's not totally correct. In this case, there is too much information out there on the internet. Yikes. Meanwhile, off to South Korea. Emergency responders in a South Korean city were called to rescue a woman whose robot vacuum cleaner latched onto her hair while she was taking a nap. The Changwon City Fire Department said workers responded to the 52-year-old woman's home after the robot vacuum cleaner latched onto her hair while she was sleeping on the floor. The emergency responders were able to open the vacuum and free the woman after about 30 minutes. The fire department said this case was quite special. We have had weird things, but this was a very weird call that we received. You figure? Yeah. The fire department said the woman lost about 10 strands of hair, but was otherwise unharmed. The device appears to be similar to the Roomba, you know, the circular robot vacuum cleaner that has sold more than 10 million units since it first hit the market back in 2002. Okay, two questions here. Why was she sleeping on the floor? And also, if she was sleeping, who turned on the vacuum? Come on, folks, we need more information. Come on. Meanwhile, the Jeju Island, a Korean restaurant in Jiangsu, China, is offering free lunch to the first 50 most beautiful patrons who come in each day. Now, before lunch, they'll be paraded through a beauty identification area where their looks will be judged by a panel of plastic surgeons who are paying for the promotion to drum up new clients. Free meal for good looking, says a sign at the restaurant, which, by the way, is in English. Local government authorities are looking into the promotion, saying it damages the city's image. Police were sent to remove the pink sign promoting the scheme since it lacked a permit. We will be more prudent with our advertising in the future, said the restaurant's manager, but the promotion will continue despite the demolition of our sign. Being practical here for a moment. If they're really selling cosmetic surgery, shouldn't they try to attract ugly people? I'm just saying. I think they're hitting the wrong target audience here. Anyway, we have time for one more Stuff File news story. Actually, two put together when you think about it. Before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a teenager in Florida underwent a first-of-its-kind medical procedure last week. The 17-year-old boy underwent the world's first penis reduction surgery. The teen requested the surgery after his penis grew too large, restricting his ability to have sex or play competitive sports. When flaccid, it measured almost 7 inches in length and had a circumference of 10 inches around. That's about the size of a grapefruit. The urologist at the University of South Florida who treated the teenager said, "There comes a time in every urologist's career that a patient makes a request so rare and impossible to comprehend that all training breaks down and leaves the physician speechless. That question was, can you make my penis smaller?" Apparently, the historic surgery was a success. It's slightly longer and slightly thicker than the average male, but now it looks symmetrical, and the patient was very satisfied, the doctor said. And right on the tail of this story comes the incredible case of a Czech woman whose vagina was so narrow that she could no longer have sex. She has undergone successful surgery to have it reconstructed using a pig's intestine. Surgeons decided to use a technique called a mesh-augmented vaginal reconstruction. Pig tissue is often used because its genetic makeup is similar to that of humans. Doctors made an incision to enlarge the narrow area. They then used the mesh made from pig's intestine to widen the walls of the vagina. That operation was also a success, and doctors now plan to publish a scientific paper on the technique. So, are you thinking what I'm thinking? Shouldn't these two medical miracles get together? I mean, think about it. This would be a couple literally made for each other. Literally. That's all I'm saying. Playing matchmaker here. It is February, after all. Okay, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? For 5 seasons, we've had the chance to watch Yvette Nicole Brown as Shirley Bennett on NBC's Community. But the actress, who, by the way, is one of our favorites here on the Stuff File program, won't be on the show when it makes its switch to Yahoo from NBC. Instead, Yvette will embark on a new role as she joins the cast of CBS's revival of The Odd Couple, starring Matthew Perry and Thomas Lennon. Yvette, who is very, very busy these days, has taken a few minutes to join us here to talk about that. She's on the line with us right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Yvette.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for doing this, and congratulations on the new gig.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a profound blessing in my life. I'm very happy.
Now, let's go back a little bit, because as I mentioned, Community is going on for a sixth season, this time, though, on Yahoo. But you're not on the show. What's happening there?
I needed to take some time to take care of my dad, and Community is a single-camera show, so it shoots 80 hours a week. That's roughly what we would shoot. And that's like from 5:30 in the morning to like 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, you can imagine what that's like every week. And I just couldn't do it and adequately care for my dad. So I had to, you know, ask for it to be released. And thankfully, Sony and Dan Harmon gave me their blessing. And then maybe a month or so after that, I got offered the chance to be on The Odd Couple. So really, I look at The Odd Couple as like a blessing that came because I put my family first.
And of course, The Odd Couple is a three-camera shoot and in front of a studio audience, so I guess it's an easier schedule on your time, right?
Well, yeah, it's shot kind of like a play. You have an audience, you have three or four cameras, and that's like a 25-hour work week. So, you know, we do maybe 4 hours a day. Some days are 2 hours a day. Like, it's really a easier way to work. We only have one long day, and that's the day we shoot in front of the audience, and that's maybe an eight-hour day, which is what a regular person would work, you know. So it's been a blessing to be able to come home at lunch and see my dad. And, you know, it's just a better way to manage the way my life has changed. And it just really worked out, which is a blessing.
So 5 years as playing Shirley Bennett, what's it like now bringing a new character to life?
You know, I thought it would be harder because I'm not a trained actor. I joke all the time that I'm kind of a hack. So for me, you know, I'm always surprised that I'm able to create a new person, you know, on screen. The funniest thing about Danny is this is the first time, I think, as an actress that I've actually acting using my own voice. Because as you can see, I don't sound like Shirley. My regular voice doesn't sound like Shirley. My regular voice doesn't sound like Helen, which is a character I played on Drake and Josh. But Danny on The Odd Couple sounds like me. I use my own voice for her. I use my own hair for her. Like, I feel like Danny's my coming out party as an actress in Hollywood. For the first time, I'm being fully myself as a character. That makes sense.
Well, tell us about the character that you're playing, Danny.
Danny is Oscar Madison, who is played by the fabulous Matthew Perry. She's his assistant, and Matthew is a sports reporter. He has like a sports radio show, and Danny is like the one that keeps all the plates spinning and all the balls in the air, and she's very efficient. I would have to say that her attitude is more like Florence from The Jeffersons. Like, she's efficient and she gets the job done, but she doesn't, you know, put up with a lot of nonsense. So I love that about her. And the great thing about the show is that Oscar and Felix, as you know, are roommates. It's a remake of The Odd Couple that most people saw in the 70s, and they maybe saw the Neil Simon movie or the play. They're roommates that are mismatched. And the great thing about this incarnation is that Oscar works at home, and Felix is always home as well. So all of the ensemble gets to work with both of the guys. So it's not like because I'm Oscar's assistant, I'm kind of in an office somewhere with Oscar. I'm in the house with Felix as well. So Danny has adventures with Felix. We have the fabulous Wendell Pierce, who plays Teddy, who is Oscar's sports agent. And then we have the fabulous Lindsay Sloan, who plays their downstairs neighbor. So the five of us are kind of always in the apartment, you know, putting out fires that these two guys have, you know, started between each other. So it's really been a great, great, great time, and it's a true ensemble.
So besides the voice and the look, as you've already mentioned, which one is closer to Yvette Nicole Brown, Shirley or Danny?
Oh, definitely Danny. Shirley's a mom. She's got kids. She's really, really judgmental as a Christian. Like, I'm a Christian. Like, me and Shirley share that in common, but Shirley is very judgmental and also very violent. I'm not a violent person. Where Danny is from Cleveland. She's a single woman just like me. She's from Cleveland just like me. And again, you know, she sounds like me. She's a no-nonsense person, but she's 100% herself. Like, Shirley has all these different voices she uses to manipulate people and all this stuff, and Danny just kind of straightforward. What you see is what you get. So I think I'm probably more like Danny.
Besides the better working hours in this situation, what does it feel like, the difference, the different vibe of you know, this time working in front of a studio audience as opposed to the single camera shoot you were doing before?
Well, the major difference is that, you know, I'm not with my community family. You know, I love the cast and the crew and the writers so much that, you know, it is it's bittersweet to not be there, so much so that I've visited the community set like 3 or 4 times this season already. I just pop up and go, hey, guys, what are you sitting around the table? Are we going to do the table? So it's kind of been hard for me to say goodbye and, like, kind of cut the cord. The other difference is that the audience is there. When we do community as a single-camera show, you know, you have to feel the comedic beats yourself. Like, you don't really have a clue as to if it's working or not, except for when they say cut and your castmates laugh at something you just did, or the writers, you hear the writers chuckling behind the monitors. Whereas in a multicam show, the audience tells you immediately. You say a line you've been rehearsing all week, and if it does not work, they yell cut, and all the writers come in, and there's a big, you know, huddle, and everybody tries to figure out how to make it better. So I think that multicam is maybe a more collaborative process, and that everybody's in it together and fighting for the joke. Whereas when it's single cam, you kind of work it out, you and the director work it out, and, you know, you find out once the show airs. You know, when people start writing you on Twitter going, oh, my God, that line you said was really funny. But that might be a month later or 2 months later when you get that feedback. So I think that the immediate feedback of multicam is the biggest difference besides, you know, gaining a new television family.
Now, what does it feel like going into this as the hype continues for this show to premiere later this month on CBS? I mean, you worked on an NBC show, which was a quirky little television show, the little show that could, but it was on a network that wasn't always in first place. It was in a time slot that was struggling. You're now going to a big Thursday night show on the number one network. Is there a different feel as to how this is being perceived by the general population or the press?
Well, I feel like we've probably been promoted more right now than I think Community ever was promoted. That's one thing. And second, we're getting a launching pad behind the Big Bang Theory, which I don't know if there is a better launching pad for a comedy on network television right now. So I feel like CBS has a lot of faith in us, which, you know, we joke, me and the rest of the cast, we joke like it's ours to blow. You know what I mean? At this point, if this show is not a success, America just didn't like us. They just said no thanks, because you can't come on after the Big Bang Theory and not get a certain amount of eyeballs. So it feels, it's a little overwhelming, I think, for me, because I'm used to being on a greatly beloved show that didn't have a lot of pressure in regards to, you know, a lot of people seeing it. Like, we had our same 3 to 4 million people every week, and we knew they'd watch, and we knew they'd love us and comment, but those were our buddies. Like, I always thought of the community fans as, like, part of the family. So there wasn't a lot of pushback and negative comments. You know, they just enjoyed our craziness and took the ride. Where with this situation, we got a lot. It's going to be a lot of people that see the first couple episodes. You know, we're debuting the night that 2.5 Men has its finale. So it's going to be Big Bang, us, and then an hour-long 2.5 Men. That's a huge launching pad for us, and I'm hoping and believing that that they're going to see the love that we've put into the show, and they're going to see how fabulous Matthew and Thomas are, and they're going to want to stick around and watch our episodes this season. That's what I'm hoping. So it's scary but exciting, is what I'll say.
Now, the pedigree of the show is amazing. As I mentioned to you in an online message, I mean, I was psyched to see this show because I'm a fan of Matthew Perry and Thomas Lennon. But then when I saw that you were going to be on it and Wendell Pierce, it's like, how much better can it get?
Oh, that's nice. I wouldn't put myself in with any of those people, but thank you for your very kind and possibly biased. yeah, and then we got Gary Marshall. Like, you know, it's so funny. There's been some people like, oh, they're remaking The Odd Couple. Why? And I would feel that way, too, if we didn't have Gary Marshall as an executive consultant. Like, I kind of feel like if you love the original show, the man who crafted that for you, aside from Neil Simon, is in charge of, is one of the voices behind this show as well. So I kind of feel like we're in really, really good hands. And then we have writers that worked on Modern Family and on Community. You know, it's a great, you know, Frasier. One of our writers worked for Frasier. We've got some great people, you know, creating this show. And I just feel like, you know, I just think it's wonderful. And I remember when I got the call about doing it. I mean, I don't think Bob, our showrunner, had gotten out mass. I don't think he even got to the theater. maybe he got Matthew Perry. And I was like, yes! It was just the idea of getting to work with Matthew Perry and Thomas Glennon. Like, they are my generation's legends. Like, when we're in our 60s and 70s, these will be the guys that are held up, like, you know, Betty White is held up, or, you know, Ted Danson was held up. You know, it's, I just feel like it's that level of comedic brilliance that I get to work with and learn from. You know, it's just been a blessing. I can't say anything but that.
Well, congratulations on the new show. It's The New Odd Couple, which is on CBS. A premiere date is?
February 19th, 8:30 on CBS.
Thank you very much, Nicole. Yvette, for being on the program with us. Much appreciated.
Thank you. And I got to say, you still are one of my favorite interviewers.
Thank you very much.
Got to tell you, you're really good at what you do, kiddo.
Well, thank you very much. You flatter me, Yvette. That's Yvette Nicole Brown, one of the stars of CBS's new Thursday night sitcom, The Odd Couple. It makes its premiere on Thursday, February 19th at 8:30 p.m., right after The Big Bang Theory. In Canada, it also airs on CTV at the very same time. Check your local listings.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come, we'll talk about that 1964 Beatles tour, plus Hugh O'Brien, better known as Wyatt Earp, and his memoir, Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him. Plus, of course, there is an Idiot of the Day coming your way here on the Stuff File program, and lots more Stuff File news on a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, I know Valentine's Day is behind us, but we do have a story here that deals with love. Actually, a love triangle. This love triangle story comes to you from the UK. A few weeks after splitting from her husband of 1 year, 26-year-old Gemma Patterson went out drinking with some friends. She met former infantry private, 24-year-old Tom Lawler, who had lost both of his legs to a Taliban bomb in Afghanistan. She invited him over for a tryst. The couple left Lawler's prosthetic legs downstairs and went up to the bedroom. Okay, let's stop right here for a minute. Is there some reason he needs to take his legs off before going up the stairs? That part baffles me. Anyway, that night, Patterson's husband, florist Harry Patterson, who had been out drinking himself, came by to ask his estranged wife to see their dog. This was around 4:30 a.m., the back door was unlocked, and Harry let himself in, prompting Gemma to jump out of bed to see who the intruder was. She came across the defendant at the bottom of the stairs, according to prosecutor Catherine Reeve. Yes, that's a prosecutor who's explaining this, so you know where this is headed. He was very upset. She had got another mail at the address only a few weeks after splitting up, after a long-term relationship. Harry then allegedly started punching Lawler in the head, with Lawler unable to get away, you know, without his legs, which were at the bottom of the stairs. This was a serious incident of domestic violence, said Magistrate Carl Harwood. Mr. Lawler was clearly unable to defend himself. For the assault, Harwood sentenced Harry to a suspended jail sentence, 3 months on curfew, a restraining order, and £1,156 in legal bills. That's about a little under, actually, $1,800 U.S. So, okay. Not that I'm assuming Lawler was having any trouble getting dates before, but I'm guessing now that this story is out, his dating street cred has gone through the roof. Because, you know, people are now aware of the fact, very clearly, that certain parts below the waist still work very well. Thank you very much. Anyway, this next story comes under the heading of one driver's really, really, really bad day. The man hospitalized in fair condition in January after being rammed from behind by a car while on his bicycle happened to be 50-year-old Daryl Isaacs, one of the most ubiquitous advertising personal injury lawyers in Louisville, Kentucky. Isaacs calls himself the heavy hitter and the Kentucky hammer for his aggressiveness on behalf of, among other clients, victims of traffic collisions. The soon-to-be poorer driver told police the sun got into his eyes. Uh-oh, I'm sure that driver has unborn grandchildren who will still be servicing this upcoming debt. Yikes. Moving right along, a promise to prison guards of a booze-filled orgy led to the escape of 28 inmates from a Brazilian jail. Three women in dominatrix garb conned the guards to take them to their sleeping quarters at the Nova Mutum prison, where they were plied with spiked whiskey and left unconscious. The passed-out officers were then stripped naked and handcuffed, allowing the phony party girls to steal their keys and unlock jail cells. Inmates made good their getaway through the main doors, along with some guns and ammunition. The guards were found the next morning just the way they were left, naked, handcuffed, and unsatisfied. Prison officials also found a bag containing lingerie and sexy police costumes used in the ploy. From the moment they drank the whiskey, the agents don't remember a thing, said the police chief at a news conference. One was found dizzy, trying to wake up. Another slept for the whole afternoon and couldn't even be questioned. Embarrassing photographs of the incapacitated guards, who now face charges, were posted on social media the next day. Authorities believe an 18-year-old behind bars for attempted murder and his girlfriend are behind the jailbreak. Wow, guards foiled by an 18-year-old because they acted like 15-year-olds. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 14 employees of a Framingham, Massachusetts pharmacy were indicted in December for defrauding the federal government by filing bogus prescriptions, despite an owner's explicit instructions to staff that the fake customer names must resemble real ones with no obviously fake names that might tip off law enforcement. So you see where this is going, don't you? Yeah. Among the names later found on the customer list of the New England Compounding Center were Baby Jesus. I have to spell this next one out for you. H-U-G-H. That's the name Hugh. The last name Jass. J-A-S-S. Put it together. Hugh Jass. Yeah. L.L. Bean. Filet-O-Fish. Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, Harry Potter, Coco Puff, Mary Lamb, all of the Baldwin brother actors, and a group of beer or alcohol-related names. There was Budweiser, Richard Coors, Raymond Rolling Rock, and, of course, Samuel Adams. The indictments were part of an investigation of a 2012 meningitis outbreak in which 64 people died. Okay, you know, these Nimrods came dangerously close to being the idiots of the day, because really, how stupid can you be to come up with fake names like this in a fraud scheme? That's daft. Really daft. But anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? In the summer of 1964, the Beatles embarked on a record-breaking, pandemonium-inducing tour of America and Canada. Author-journalist Ivor Davis, then a young reporter for the London Daily Express, traveled with the Beatles as the only British newspaper writer invited on the entire tour. His latest book is The Beatles and Me on Tour, and he joins us on the line right now from California to talk about it. Hi, Ivor.
Good day to you, Peter. Good day.
Nice to have you on the program. I'm curious to know, back then, when that pandemonium was taking place in 1964, how long into the tour did you get a sense that, wow, I'm really part of something that's historical here?
Well, first of all, I was a young guy like the Beatles, and we didn't look back, and we didn't have the ability to evaluate the way we're doing it right now. But let me tell you, Peter, the moment I hit San Francisco to join the Beatles and discovered 4,000 young women outside their hotel screaming, I knew something was afoot. And then, of course, during the tour all the way across America into Canada, the same thing happened. I thought, this is quite insane, and this must be par for the course. Of course, I didn't know it wasn't, and I didn't know that the Beatles were about to make rock and roll history.
At any point during the tour, did you find that John, Paul, George, and Ringo themselves were in any way, shape, or form overwhelmed by the adulation they were receiving?
Well, they were overwhelmed, and the only problem, the only complaint they ever made to me on the tour, and those were the days when you could get very up close and personal with the Beatles. You know, I was in the next room to them, and we drank with them, and we played cards and Monopoly with them. They never really knew that it would be so record-breaking. But don't forget, Peter, what happened a few months earlier was they got incredible acclaim in England, in Europe, Australia, but America was the prize, and they didn't realize they would be so hugely successful until they got there.
What was the biggest thrill or revelation for you along the course of the tour?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and it's a hard question to answer, because I can tell you that none of us knew what was going to happen. But the idea was, for me, as a lad from the East End of London, which is kind of the poor district, I was in the second limousine. The Beatles were in the first limousine. And at every city we arrived at, there were police escorts, screaming motorcycles, and I felt like a member of royalty. I didn't know. I mean, this wasn't the way I was used to traveling, but this was the way that the Beatles got used to traveling.
Less than a decade later, the Beatles had broken up. Time has gone by. Why did you wait 50 years to write this book?
Well, you know, I have all my life been a journalist. And the way journalists on daily newspapers work is they do a story on Monday, they write it, and on Tuesday it appears, and then on Wednesday they go on to the next story. To be honest with you, I never really thought it was such a fantastic story until I started telling people about it at dinner parties, and they were mesmerized and said, get it down, write about it, because you had a unique seat in rock and roll history. So I finally got off my backside and decided to write it half a century later.
You've been in journalism for a long time. You've also been primarily in entertainment journalism for a long time. And one of the things I have to say right off the bat that I'm impressed by is the fact that, you know, that there's a fine line these days between entertainment journalism and just plain gossip. And I like the fact that you practice entertainment journalism.
Well, yes. I mean, but don't forget today, Peter, look at the communication that we have. I mean, if you sneeze and have the flu, everybody from Montreal to California knows it within 10 seconds. I mean, I'm being a bit facetious here, but you know what I mean. You know, the communication today has a machine that absolutely gobbles up gossip and spews it out to everybody waiting to find out. back then, we didn't have Twitter. Only birds twittered. And we didn't have the internet. So the gossip machine is mighty, mighty, mighty today, not as big as it was back then.
So what are some of the tidbits you can share with us from being backstage, behind the scenes with the Beatles? For instance, I know you mentioned just a few moments ago that you played Monopoly with the guys.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was that John and George and Paul and Ringo were prisoners in their hotels. Wherever they were, they couldn't step outside for fear of being really torn limb from limb. So they were prisoners in their hotel. I was on the same floor in the next room. So John would call me at 3 a.m. and say, hey, we're playing Monopoly, come over. So I'd come over at 3 a.m. John cheated very much in Monopoly to try and win. And we hung out with them, and we drank with them, and we joked with them, and we heard their complaints about the terrible sound systems. So we were rubbing shoulders with them in a way that today you never could.
I just have to ask, you know, five guys from Britain, did you play the American or the British version of Monopoly?
You know, John brought the British version, and that was one of the few things he brought over with him, and he loved to buy Mayfair, which is one of the most expensive regions in London. But don't forget, John grew up in a fairly poor neighborhood in Liverpool. So he knew the price of property, although in those days, he wasn't big on money. And none of the Beatles were big on money. I mean, they just were doled out spending money by Brian Epstein, their manager. And whenever they needed to buy anything, they just asked the road managers for some cash.
Now, in traveling with the Beatles, they became a legend in a very short period of time and got a chance to meet and hang out with other musical artists of the day. I guess you were a witness and privy to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the idea was when the Beatles came over, everybody in Hollywood wanted the magic fairy dust to rub off from the Beatles to them. And so the Beatles and Brian Epstein were very cautious about who they hung out with. A lot of people like Jane Mansfield, the movie star sex symbol of the era, tried very hard to get pictures and close with the Beatles. Actually, she did. But the Beatles themselves liked a handful of people, including Bob Dylan, of course, who was a great fan of theirs, and they were a fan of his. They loved his girlfriend of the period, which was Joan Baez, and they met her, and they liked her. John liked her particularly, much to Dylan's chagrin. And they also liked Elvis Presley, and they actually got to meet Elvis Presley the following year, 1965, which was quite an amazing meeting because both the Beatles and Presley were very uncomfortable at Elvis's house, and it took about 30 minutes for the ice to break, and when the ice broke, they started jamming, and they got fairly friendly. Mm. So that was the showbiz crowd that they liked.
Now that you've written this book, have you been in contact with the two surviving members of the Beatles through the years, and are they aware of you writing this book?
I think they're aware of my book. I mean, they are told about all the books that are written. I haven't heard anything personal. I did go and see Ringo perform in Santa Barbara, California, and then about 400 people were waiting to go backstage, so I thought, I'm going to go home. And then, of course, in the Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, there were about 55,000 people with Paul McCartney. But I did see the Beatles and spoken to the Beatles over the years since the American tour. I wouldn't say that we're close friends, but when I see them, they're very friendly, and we talk about the old times.
You've seen what it's like to be in that entourage, in that phenomenon from the inside. Did you ever, as a journalist, want to talk to some of the girls, for instance, who were just so fan-filled with the Beatles that they could hardly breathe? Did you ever want to delve into what became their reason for being part of the Beatles phenomenon?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because at the time, I didn't really talk to them because they were all there screaming hysterically. But since then, and since I wrote the book, I've met many, many young women of the time who are now older women. And one lady who runs a huge corporation in San Francisco said to me, I said, weren't you one? She said she was one of the screamers. I said, why did you stand there screaming? She said, because I was in love with Ringo, and Ringo was in love with me. And I said, well, how do you know that? She said, well, When I waved and smiled at Ringo during the concert at San Francisco Cow Palace, he waved back at me, and I knew he loved me as well. And you know, that was in microcosm, the way the women were, the young women were, at all the concerts. They fell in love with one of the four Beatles, and they felt that that love was reciprocated, and that's why they were there. They screamed so much they couldn't hear what was going on, and the Beatles couldn't hear themselves sing, but who cared anyway? Love shines through.
It was an amazing time. People can also find out more information, by the way, by going to your website, which is ivordavisbeatles.com, correct?
Correct. Thank you for saying that. And I must tell you, I have had a terrific time since the book came out. I've met Beatles fans who have sensational memories of the time and share them with me, and I've enjoyed it, and they've enjoyed it. So it's a whole new world that's opened up to me, Peter.
Ivor, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
For having me. All the best.
Ivor Davis, author of The Beatles and Me on Tour. You can check out his website at ivordavisbeatles.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0287, and you'll find the link, plus also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. An Oregon man is suing Walmart for $13 million after pouring gasoline on a fire and creating a fireball that burned over half his body. His lawyer says he's suing Walmart because the retailer sold his client the gas can. Walmart's fighting the lawsuit, saying the can met safety standards and had a large warning stamped on it that cautioned against using gas to start fires. Not listed in the lawsuit is the company that actually made the gas can. Why? Only because it had already gone bankrupt because of lawsuits like this. Until that happened, the company had been the largest manufacturer of gas cans in America. It even supplied the U.S. military during World War II and literally helped fuel the Allied victory. Let's be fair, this company helped General Eisenhower destroy the Nazi war machine, but in the end, even though it was making a product used safely by millions, it couldn't defend itself against the barrage of lawsuits that have now become so common in America's courts. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the legendary Hugh O'Brien. Plus, we will indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. Stick around for that. This is a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, as you know, the smarter way to listen to radio. Have I said that already? And if you don't know that, let me explain very briefly. A Stitcher is radio on demand. You can download their free app and listen anytime, anywhere. And you can hear over 20,000 of your favorite shows, if you have that many. You have a lot to choose from, including this very program, the Stuff File program. Over 20,000 different shows to discover. You can even rate and review shows that are on Stitcher. So if you like this one, for instance, please go ahead and share your thoughts and rate this show if you'd like. Much appreciated. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Download it, get it, enjoy it. It's worth it, okay? Now, back to the Stuff File news here. Okay, we have a couple of compelling explanations here. The first one, to say the least, is extremely lame. 51-year-old Briton Roberto Collins was sentenced to 13 years in jail by Manchester Crown Court in January after being caught standing on a ladies' room toilet and peeing into the next stall. He told police he stood up only to better scratch an itch and was in the ladies' room only because, wearing faulty glasses, he thought he was in the men's room. Okay, even if I gave him the benefit of the doubt on the glasses part, what kind of itch could you have that would require you to stand on a toilet? Yeah. And lame item number two, 25-year-old Scotsman Dean Gilmartin actually persuaded a judge at Perth Sheriff Court in January of his innocence that he might not have been masturbating at the front window of his home. He admitted he was nude, he was actually in the process of changing clothes, but pointed out that he plays musical instruments and was probably just picking out tunes on his ukulele rather than holding his genitals and moving side to side as the neighbor had charged. Well, perhaps Gladys Kravitz next door really needs some glasses. Better glasses than the guy in the woman's washroom from earlier. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff Out program, shall we? Hugh O'Brien is an acting legend and one of the few remaining classic Western stars. He's probably best remembered as the star of the TV series The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp. Hugh has written his memoir entitled Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him. He joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Hugh.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. The title of your book is Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him. What do you mean by what's left of him?
Well, when you get to be 89 like I am, certain things are not happening anymore. One of those for me is my old Marine Corps knees, and therefore I'm using a walker. But that's kind of fun because using the walker always gets me somehow into first class, whatever it is. You have an absolutely great location where you're calling from. I have a great love and a great respect for Canada.
Yes, I understand you have three of your Hugh O'Brien Youth Organization locations up here in Canada.
Three locations up there. It's Ottawa, Edmonton, and Western Canada. That's Hugh O'Brien Youth Leadership, or HOVY, which is the short version, HOVY.org. And by the way, there's a tremendous opportunity for anyone that is interested in helping ensure your future in your great country by becoming involved with the HOVY program, which is up there. The high school select make it available to 10th graders, 15, 16 years of age, and they select one or two to go to the HOVY program.
Yes, it's a great program, and again, people can find out more information by going to HOVY.org. That's HOBY.org. Now, you've had quite an amazing life, sir.
One way or the other, it's been a great life. One of the great things about it is I have a great wife, and I spent a lot of time looking around before I met her. She's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Not just my wife, she's my life. And she just happens to be the greatest cook in the world. So come out and have dinner with her sometime.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about your book. You wrote this book. What made you decide to write it now?
Well, the cemetery offered me a discount if I would write the book. So anyway, whatever reason, I've had a lot of stories, a lot of wonderful things happen in my life, and a bunch of people, including my dear lovely lady wife, encouraged me to stop reading the Wall Street Journal or whatever and write it down in the form of a book. And that's what I did.
You have very fond memories of working with John Wayne, don't you?
I care very much about John Wayne. In 1943, when I enlisted in the Marine Corps and went through boot camp here in this part of the world, San Diego, he came down and visited us. He was making a film, and he loved the Marine Corps. So I made good friends with him way before I got into showbiz. And his, by the way, he was helpful in helping me find a good agent. He was quite a man, a wonderful, wonderful human being.
You were the last person, if I'm not mistaken, you were the last person to be killed by John Wayne.
I was the last person. When I did the role, I insisted on authenticity. And he liked that very much, and he made it very clear to the crew that if I had any questions or whatever about the authenticity on that show, that he would back me 100%. And there's a stunt in the film. He jumps over the bar when we start the gunfight, man running out of the saloon. I shot him in the back, like the character that Wayne playing. Did that agree with that? He hated it, hated me for doing it. And as I shot the guy, he jumped over the bar. And the idea of it was that I would get down on my knees when I got to the bar, and I would crawl around the bar at the end and peek around the bar, see where he was, so I could shoot him and kill him. And as I came around the bar and looked, I get this bullet right in the middle of my forehead, between the two eyes. Plunk there, what did they do? My actually being shot, and because they thought the phony squid, which often they use, it would show up in the close-up. But I said, let me try it. And they said, you'll trust the guy with the rifle, the stuntman, playing John Wayne? I said, yeah, that's what I'm being paid for. I will try it. They said, we'll have a practice. I said, no, I'm only going to do it once. But when I come around the bar, the guy lets me have it between my eyes and on my forehead. He shoots me. And they had the pellet guns. Shoots a blood capsule, and as I came around the end of the bar, and within an eighth of an inch of where I was supposed to be, knowing that the guy was going to shoot me, and the worst thing in the world could happen if I came around the end and I had my eyes shut. I said, no, let's try it. And I came around the end of the bar, the guy pulled the trigger, and if you see the film, you'll see that that load, that quid goes right between my eyes, just about an inch above them on the middle of my forehead. Everybody thought I was crazy for doing it, but it sure made a difference when you see the film to see the actual guy being killed that way. Doing my own stunts has been something I became known for. Made a lot of difference in terms of people hiring me because they knew I was willing to try anything.
And people can read your stories and hear what you have experienced by reading your book, Hugh O'Brien, or What's Left of Him. I'm glad there is still a lot left of you that we could talk about it and share some of your experiences. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much. And by the way, if anybody would like to contact me or would like possibly to get the book or whatever, they can reach me on Facebook. Do you have kids?
No, I don't. I don't.
Well, my leadership program, Hoagie.
Yes.
Please, I would appreciate anybody listening. Take the time to take a look at it. HOBY.org is how they can find it. Leadership Development for 10th Graders. I have 98.6% of every high school in the United States, 10 other countries, including Iraq and Canada, that do take place, do send, select your 10th grade potential leader, send them to the Hoagie Canada seminar. And they can find that on Hoagie, H-O-B-Y, Canada.org. And my best to all the beautiful people in your great country.
Thank you very much, sir.
Glad we're neighbors. Bye-bye.
Legendary actor Hugh O'Brien. His book is called Hugh O'Brien or What's Left of Him. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0287, and you'll find links to Hugh's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You'll also find links to his youth organization at Hoagie.org, that's H-O-B-Y.org, and in Canada at HoagieCanada.org. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
There were those who speculated that the Seattle Seahawks would win the Super Bowl over the New England Patriots. Heck, I was one of the people who thought the Seahawks was going to pull it off, but I wouldn't bet my house on it, and I certainly wouldn't have gotten a tattoo. But a diehard Hawks fan who prematurely got a Seahawks back-to-back Super Bowl champions tattoo plans to keep his ink even after Seattle's heartbreaking loss. Talk about premature jubilation. The fan who goes by the name OC and now lives in Jacksonville, Florida, because, you know, everything happens in Florida, got his optimistic tattoo in December before the Seahawks ran through the playoffs. Obviously, I'm gonna keep it. I already threw away the receipt, he added, laughing. I don't regret getting it. It's been a fun ride. I like to take risks. I could tattoo the word almost above it, OC joked. Nobody can question whether I'm a fan or not. Well, that's true. They can also not question one other undeniable fact. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0287. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0287. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.